Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 37, Copyright in Extremis.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcast.com/TWiL. And by listeners like you. Thanks so much for your contribution. We couldn't do TWiT without it.
Hi, this is Denise Howell, and you've turned in for This Week in Law, episode 37. Welcome to the show. I'm here with our panel of regulars. We've got Evan Brown from internetcases.com. Hi, Evan.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you?
Great. How are you today?
Not too bad. It's a nice sunny afternoon here in Chicago, so it's a good day.
Good deal. Also with us is Ernie Svensson. Hi, Ernie. Ernie, are you muted? I see you talking.
Oh, now I think we're all been guilty of that.
Unplugged. Very nice.
Well, that's a new one.
Well, while Ernie plugs in, I'll introduce Colette. Hi, Colette.
Hi, Denise. Hi, Evan, Ernie. Good to see you guys.
Colette Vogel from VogelLaw.com. Great to have you on the show.
We're having a crazy rainy gray day here, Evan. So I think our roles have reversed.
Yeah, well, it's got to be November somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Southern California can't decide what it's doing. It's going from cold to heat wave, which, as I remember last year, is what we did as well. So maybe it's just global warming taking hold. Ernie, have you plugged in? We can all see you on the video.
Ernie's going to pantomime this week.
I don't know what he is doing. Something's cut.
He's going to talk about the ACTA treaty, you know, just acting it out, you know.
Oh, he'll act out the ACTA treaty. That would be great. I don't know. He is monkeying around with his headset from what I can tell. Hold on.
Help.
Holding up signs to the video monitor. Okay, well, while Ernie works out his technical difficulties, I'll get our preliminary housekeeping underway as we get slowly rolling along here with TWiL. First of all, we've got a wave that people can come chat with us if you're tuned into the show live. If you want to tune into the show live, and if you're listening to this at 11 o'clock on Friday, November 6th, then you are listening live. And you're following along probably at live.twit.tv. Or if you've tuned in to the podcast after the fact, know that you can watch us Fridays at 11 a.m. at live.twit.tv. Also, we've got a wave going. That's at denise.howell.net/wave37. Come kick the tires on Google Wave and participate in our back channel for the show. Other back channels also going at irc.twit.tv and at denise.howell.net/TWiL37. That is the friend feed chat. So come participate with us whenever you can. It seems like the waves have been living on after the show too. So if you have any comments or contributions you want to make after the show, if you're not listening with us live, you can go to that wave and see what went on and add your own 2 cents. So our link list this week is so long. There is no way we're going to make it through everything that has been going on this week. But I do want to definitely hit some of the highlights. And what the overarching theme seems to be is just new battles and skirmishes in the copyright wars on various fronts. Let us start out with the ACTA treaty, since we did mention that, and perhaps Ernie's going to pantomime it on video. The ACTA treaty, and let me get you the what that acronym stands for. It's the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, and this is a copyright treaty the text of which has been being withheld on national security grounds. I take it that it is not final yet and is something that is still being hammered out. But some of the text has leaked, and there are a couple of stories on Boing Boing where people can find out more about this. The first, Cory Doctorow's post on November 3rd, is headlined, Secret Copyright Treaty Leaks. It's bad, very bad. So you can check out all of Cory's reasons why he thinks it's bad, but a lot of it has to do with the role of ISPs under this structure and what they would be required to do. Now, I don't know if you guys have picked it up yet, Colette and Evan and Ernie, if you're there in spirit or otherwise, but have you guys checked out Professor Patry's new book yet, which is called Moral Panics? Let's see.
Moral Panics in the Copyright Wars, isn't it?
Yes, that is it. And it has own blog, if people want to check that out, lengthily called Moral Panics and the Copyright Wars.blogspot.com. But these ACT appoints seem to really go right along with what Professor Patry is writing about in the early part of his book. I just started it. It's wonderful. Folks should definitely pick it up. And if you're a listener to this show, I guarantee you, you will enjoy the book, whichever side of the copyright wars you fall on. It might make you angry in a Glenn Beck sort of way if you're not completely politically aligned with where Professor Patry is. But he talks about a digital guillotine, and that would be the ISP's ability to chop off your internet access if under this graduated response regime where, you know, it's sort of a three strikes, you're out. Hey, Ernie's here. Hi, Ernie.
Hi.
Great to have you. So the idea is under a graduated response, which sounds so reasonable and progressive, your ISP would be given notice of any alleged copyright violation. And then once that has happened three times, you would be booted off your internet entirely, including presumably email and including for all members of your household. For here, it's not specified what the length of time would be, and that's another issue with it, how long this penalty is. But it seems like something that is falling outside the judicial process. It's a fairly harsh penalty. And so that's one of the complaints about ACTA. Another that Cory raises is that it would compel the entirety of the world to adopt a DMCA-style notice and takedown structure that, you know, of course, it has its own detractors, to say the least, in the United States as to how well that works or not, and mandatory prohibitions on breaking DRM, and also severe penalties for non-commercial music sharing. In a follow-up post, Cory, who's bringing all this in, I think, courtesy of Professor Geist in Canada, who, let's see, says, in a few hours, the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement talks will continue on the internet provisions, and goes on to say that there would actually be jail penalties for non-commercial music sharing. What are your guys' thoughts on this and the role of this latest salvo in the copyright role at wars? Evan, you want to start out?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm probably, I would love to read Professor Patry's, or I guess, you know, Bill Patry's, he's not a professor anymore, Bill Patry's book when it comes out on audible.com. So I'll wait till there. I haven't read the book yet, but it looks good, but I'd like to listen to it.
Believe you me, I did check to see if that could be our Audible pick today. Unfortunately, it's published from Oxford University Press, and I don't think they've quite gotten around to getting it on Audible yet, but hopefully someday it will.
All right. Well, my take on this is, you know, I always try to recognize times when people are going around shouting that the sky is falling, and when it's appropriate to say, you know, the sky really is not falling. Let's be a little bit more measured here. And that's what I would like to to the approach that I would like to take on this one. I was, you know, watching Twitter pretty closely in the last couple of days to see what people were saying about this, you know, the whole, you know, controversy over the ACTA negotiations. And you know, almost uniformly, the only content that I could see on Twitter, and, you know, granted, that's a very unscientific way to look at the whole picture, but, you know, I think it gives us a pretty good insight onto it. Almost, you know, homogeneously, people were either linking to what Professor Geist was writing, or even more so and more passionately and more fervently to what Cory Doctorow was writing on Boing Boing, which was based on information that he'd gotten from Professor Geist. And so I'm like thinking, come on, sheeple. Cory Doctorow is not, you know, the be all and end all of what this is all about. I mean, he's a great guy. He's a great author. He's really fun to listen to. And I know that you've collaborated with him before on podcasts, you know, back in the early days of podcasting, at least. But, you know, Cory Doctorow has a very certain view on copyright that is, I will submit that it's very different than what maybe the mainstream person in America might think on copyright here. Infringement is a very serious problem. No matter how irritated we get about, you know, the antics and the shenanigans of big media and big content providers, you know, being all terrible and up in our grill, wanting to get, you know, cut us off the internet for sharing a single song or whatever. Infringement is a very serious problem, and that problem is magnified even more so when it becomes an international problem. I mean, I represent, you know, a lot of content producers, you know, people who own copyrights in their stuff. And, you know, surprise, surprise, they actually care about their proprietary rights in that. And I know, Colette, you have clients this way too. Creative people, you know, copyright rights are important. And I also represent a lot of intermediaries too, who are very troubled by, you know, this whole notion of having to respond to DMCA takedown notices and, you know, the hassle that would be involved if, you know, they didn't have the DMCA here to, you know, to kind of protect them and give them a kind of slick mechanism to go through here. I just really think that it's important that this whole notion of how to handle infringement on an international global scale, it's very important that that issue be addressed. I also am not so quick to criticize this whole notion of graduated response, which is kind of the euphemistic way of saying the three strikes and you're out. You know, your three strikes, you're off the web or off the internet. You're disconnected from the internet. People, you know, critics of this like to say, oh, well, it's, you know, it's all done without trial or without involvement of the judicial process. So it's obviously, you know, clearly a due process violation and all that stuff. I really don't think that that's entirely accurate to say that. What the graduated response, I think you called it a regime, you know, or the system would be here, it would be to require ISPs to have contractual relationships with their customers so that if they are accused of infringement three times, then their internet access is terminated. It's a matter of contract. To say that an individual user would be completely without a judicial remedy is wrong. Because if you feel that you have been wrongfully terminated, at least in the United States, and I'm sure in most civilized nations, you can petition a court, you know, a declaratory judgment action to say, Judge, this contract was wrongfully terminated. Or you could even sue for breach of contract. There's a couple of different judicial ways, you know, ways you could go about it here. So that's one reason that I think that the sky isn't necessarily a problem. And just one more quick thing here. Cory Doctorow says something like that these provisions would require intermediaries to take active steps to police content. And so therefore he said something like, there will be no more Flickr, no Blogger, no YouTube, because it'll cost too much to have lawyers reviewing all this content. I just think that that's wrong. I don't see that anywhere in you know, the proposal or the stuff that's leaked out here, which is all still very kind of secretive and mysterious, and we're just getting things second and third hand. That's just plain out wrong. The ACTA provisions that are being proposed do not impose an affirmative obligation on ISPs to actively screen for content. What it's trying to do is just normalize and broaden the requirements of some kind of notice and takedown system, which I submit is not nearly as big of a failure in the U.S. is what many would like to say. So there, I'll step off my soapbox and you know, take a deep breath.
I'd like to chime in.
Colette, why don't you fire away?
Yeah. Yeah. So my biggest concern is something that Evan has kind of swept under the rug is that, oh, yeah, well, you can always come back and say later, my stuff was wrongfully removed in the DMCA context or in the context of whatever these ACTA provisions are, that, oh, I've been harmed because my free speech was taken down by my ISP or my YouTube or whoever. And the problem is the harm happens when the letter is sent, when the cease and desist letter is sent, when the DMCA takedown is sent or whatever they're going to have under this ACTA type provision, the harm happens there because I would venture to guess that the vast majority of times that the message is sent to the intermediary, the content comes down and the user never responds or fights back because A, they don't understand how, B, they're not sure whether they did something wrong, they don't have the resources and the time to deal with making it right, and thirdly, even if it was wrongfully taken down, access to the courts is not like it, like going to small claims court for your $5,000 judgment. You have to be in federal court. You have to file a filing fee. You have to have somebody who knows what they're doing, who doesn't get their ass, you know, screwed up, you know, in how they've presented their pleadings. And if it's anything like the Lens case, if anybody's been following that, and we had Cindy on a few weeks ago, Denise, the way the lawyering in that case has been going is just unbelievably strong. I mean, I think that, you know, Universal is doing everything they can to make it as expensive as possible and doing everything they can to make Lens exercising her right to have had the content up about her dancing baby up. And if that's the message the content industry wants to send to the internet users, we're going to send takedown notices. And if you fight us, we're going to fight you to the, you know, tooth and nail to the end. That's a scary message. And it's not helping, you know, the expansion of creativity. It's not helping, you know, free speech, and it's not helping other things. And the other thing I want to say is, you know, I'm not an expert at all on these international treaties, but my understanding and the things I've seen just in reading the paper about the USTR and other trade agreements, the agreements we're making with foreign governments that are less developed than ours in some ways are impacting their development of IP laws and requiring things that we don't have in our country that make it much more expensive and squelch some of the free speech opportunities in these other countries that in some places where it's more even more important than here. So I just want to say, like, what we're negotiating behind closed doors in these treaty things will really affect or could really affect society's development, cultural development, sharing, internationalization, all sorts of things. And I'm very nervous, especially with these things being sort of behind closed doors and things having to be leaked and really knowing if we know what's going on and how these treaties will impact our domestic law as well as international relations. There we go.
There we go. Yeah, I'm with you. This, you know, assuming that this leaked information is accurate, where this is going scares me as well. And it does so because, you know, not that I am at all opposed to a copyright regime, one that is appropriately bounded, but I think that what this does is take the enforcement mechanism and just, you know, turbocharge it for the content industry. It's sidetracking or end running, I guess is the word I'm looking for, our traditional enforcement mechanisms for copyright and really giving a penalty without having to go through the process that would ordinarily be involved and really stiff penalties, it sounds like.
Why do you say that it would be a penalty without going through the processes that are ordinarily involved? We're just talking about cutting off internet access here. And yeah, that really sucks.
Just cutting off internet access, Evan? Yeah.
Well,
it's like, you know, just cutting like off only power and electricity and water.
Okay, fine. Let's talk about cutting off your power and your electricity. You don't have to go to the power company, doesn't have to take you to court to shut off your power if you haven't paid your bill.
Paying bills.
We're talking about a breach of a contract. When you sign up for, you know, your internet service provider, you will agree not to, you know, transmit infringing materials through that. They don't have to get an adjudication that you haven't paid your bill in order to shut the power off.
Wait.
Why aren't we extending this? One second, Ernie. Why aren't we extending this then to the power company as well? Because you need their services to engage in your infringement too. I mean, I think this just takes it to a ludicrous level of imbalanced leverage. on the part of the content industry. And if and there's really no reason to distinguish between cutting off your internet access and cutting off your power. You know, you need both of them to be able to engage in the kind of infringement that we're talking about here. So, and both of them are used for lots of other purposes as well. So I think it illustrates the overbreadth problem as far as that being a remedy without any kind of, you know, even lawsuit being filed or proof of infringement. When you think about how these kinds of things are proved up, and how much comedy there has been. I mean, it's not comedy if you're the person on the receiving end of it. But in the RAAA lawsuits, for example, where they're mechanically deciding who has engaged in file sharing through these third-party companies who have notoriously gotten it so wrong that people without computers have been sued and people who are dead have been sued. You know, I'm certainly not ready to trust that degree of proof and consequence to a contractual arrangement between the content industry and ISPs. I don't know. Ernie, I cut you off.
Okay, go ahead.
No, I was just, you know, you captured a lot of what I was going to say. And I think the basic difference between the power, you know, cutoff example that Evan just gave and the example of cutting off somebody's internet access for these transgressions involving copyright infringement is that nobody's going to cut your power off for reasons that require a lot of interpretation. It's going to be, did we get paid or not? Oh, gee, we didn't get paid. And this is a universal problem. I mean, it's not a question of you're up to something that we deem to be bad. And it's also not, it's the internet. There, the power cutoff is the power company's not getting paid. It's their self-interest that is being violated. It's a pure mechanical thing. You didn't pay some money. Now here, it's somebody saying, hey, internet service provider, we have evidence that, you know, yada, 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 and they provide this evidence to the ISP, and the ISP has to make a judgment call. And what are they going to do? If the penalties are such that the incentive is for them to say, well, gee, you know, we'd like to give them internet access and make a few extra bucks, but on the other hand, we have to deal with all these lawyers, and it looks like they have the paperwork in order. Okay, fine, we cut them off. And now it's up to them to go get a lawyer and do all of the stuff that Colette just talked about. No, that's ridiculous. That's putting the burden on a person who doesn't have the means to fight back. And it involves a judgment call. So those are the two principles that make it completely different than the power being cut off.
It's not Evan, I want you to respond to all this, but I want to throw out too the fact that, you know, ISPs, I guess, have been somewhat resistant to this, and part of that resistance must be they don't want to have to alienate or lose paying customers, but when you spin that out and consider how they're going to have to respond to this, if this is something that becomes a matter of law or international treaty or both, how they're going to have to respond to that is to contractually build in, you know, they're already locking you in for set periods of time. For example, my cable service has me locked in for 3 years, and that's my internet access. They're going to have to contractually build in that even if they boot you off under these provisions, you're obligated to keep paying and honor your contract. I think that's the only way they're going to be able to survive this. So, and that certainly, you know, just piles on to the problems I see with this kind of an approach. Evan, how about it?
Yeah, well, you know, these are all great points. And you know, I think we're having a pretty intelligent and principled discussion on it here. And I don't, you know, want to be so polarized to think that, you know, I just want to go around terminating everybody's internet access. But what I would say is, you know, I haven't read any case law, you know, coming from the Supreme Court or any court of appeal or anything that says internet access is a fundamental right and that there's some, you know, due process right that you have here, especially when it's looked and framed in terms of a contractual arrangement between the end user and the internet service provider. You know, I think it's easy to, you know, to discount and to, you know, forsake the interests of the content owners, because when we think of the content owners versus the individual users, we tend to think of content owners as synonymous with Hollywood and big media, but that's not always the case. There are plenty. I mean, I have represented scores of, you know, small people trying to just make a living on, you know, their creative content that's being, you know, ripped off left and right, especially, you know, from servers in China and stuff like that. So, I just don't want to be so polarizing in saying that it's just, you know, this it's absolutely good or it's absolutely bad, but we need to look at it carefully in terms of contract language. Another thing, a point that would make this a little bit different than the individuals fighting back in the RIAA cases where they've been sued for copyright infringement. And, you know, you've got this monolithic team of lawyers from the content industry going after the little people here. Again, this is just, we would be talking about an ISP exercising a contractual right, which is imposed on it by an obligation put on by the law to terminate access to somebody who has been alleged three times to have committed copyright infringement through the system. Again, you are not, the individual user is not left without a judicial remedy. And I would submit that you wouldn't even have to go to federal court on this, even though it may be, you know, this copyright issue kind of informing this or, you know, creating it or causing it. I know, Colette, you were talking about, you know, having to go to federal court and you have to lawyer up and all that stuff. I think I could walk down to municipal court here, small claims court, and say, judge, you know, this contract that I had with my ISP, arising under and to be interpreted under state law, that was my service was wrongfully terminated in breach of that contract. Or if I'm being threatened, I could go in and ask the same court for a declaratory judgment. Wouldn't have to lawyer up. Probably wouldn't have to meet up with, you know, some fancy big law lawyer from, you know, representing the ISP or the content owner. I think that there is clearly, I mean, even though there is no due process right to internet access, I think that even in light of that, and in addition to that, you have the reasonable person has available, the average person has available to them an easily accessible judicial remedy on this.
Well, I'm sure that other companies that provide services of a utility-like nature protect themselves contractually in the language between their customers and themselves from those sorts of wrongful termination claims, you know, that they build in a whole lot of structure and unilateral ability to be able to boot their customers and protect themselves when they've done so. And I think that we would see that kind of approach come in, you know, that they have certain standards that they're going to have to adhere to. And if those standards are followed, then they're going to be protected. And I fear that the standards are not going to be sufficient to protect the users, you know, that go ahead.
Well, in every contract, at least in most jurisdictions that I know of, I'm licensed to practice in Illinois and Colorado, so I can't speak for everyone, but I learned in law school that in every contract, there's an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. And if the evidence is going to be as laughable and flimsy as what we think it might be, you know, that there is infringement that's going on here, then I don't think any reasonable court would, find in favor of an ISP who is acting in bad faith terminating a contract, even if the contract between that ISP and its individual user says, hey, we can't be liable if we terminate your service based on flimsy evidence. I mean, there would be a threshold or at least a bottom floor here for good faith and fair dealing built into all this stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm just suspicious of how these things would be structured, but I think, you know, they could make it sound quite reasonable that, oh, you know, if we get reports from X, Y, and Z company, then we've done our bit and we can't be pursued. But what happens?
Well, then it's
when
probably true.
Little,
I mean, well, sometimes people actually will infringe over the internet. You know, imagine that.
No, absolutely. People will and do. But for this to be the remedy, I think captures a whole lot of non-infringing conduct, or subjects a lot of non-infringing conduct to a lot of risk.
Yeah.
Unnecessarily, I think. But
yes, I agree.
I think what we're saying is it's the chilling, the classic sort of chilling effect problem. My worry is, yes, in writing in a contract or in a statute, whatever the governing document is, things look simple. But in practice, we are trained as lawyers to look for everything. And if we have a client whose rights they need to be exercise both on the plaintiff side or the defense side, and I do work on both sides in copyright matters, you fight for the things that you think will win your case. And I just think that it's not as simple as a special court to handle these things, or a small claims court, you know, opportunity for a customer whose internet has been cut off. I mean, I think of it as the telephone. It is a very important communication tool, and it's almost as important as the electricity in your house if you want to, you know, interact with the outside world for some people. And I'm really concerned about having anything globally that will, put the burden on the intermediary and also cut people off without having a true meaningful opportunity to contest the thing. And I'm not saying that there's no, piracy happening on the internet. I'm not saying that there's nobody doing illegal content distribution. I've had to enforce my own rights in some of my content that's been shared on the internet.
As has Cory Doctorow.
Yeah, sure.
Remember when he sent the DMCA takedown notice for boringboring.net a couple years ago? He was quick to exercise those remedies that he's so critical of now.
I don't think Corey's critical of the remedies. I think he's critical of the way that they are capable of being misused.
Yeah, fair enough. Colette, just to add a footnote to what you said there, you're saying that you think internet access is as important as the electricity or as the air we breathe. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm exaggerating a little bit there. But just this past week, the Supreme Court of New Hampshire held that, and I wrote about this on my blog. You can read about it. The Supreme Court of New Hampshire held that it was a violation of a landlord-tenant statute in that state for the landlord to disconnect the cable TV service, and exercising a self-help remedy for a non-paying tenant. Even when the tenant said, "Hey, landlord, I'm not going to pay rent anymore. Come and get me." In the meantime, he cut off the cable TV service, and the court held that that was a protected utility, even though it wasn't specifically mentioned in the statute of things that you can't cut off. The statute says you can't cut off the utilities like water, electricity, sewerage, all that stuff. The court held that because this is so important, and it actually mentioned the importance of internet access, this is a protected utility under that statute. And so, I definitely think that sensibility goes along right with what you're saying about how internet access is so important, especially if you're, utilizing VoIP services and things like that. So right on.
Yeah. Sure. And there's always SpongeBob. I mean, goodness, you can't cut that off.
I, of course, mentioned porn in my blog post, but, whatever.
Well, that could be essential for some people, too.
It's just as important as, whatever. Never mind. I'm going to
discuss this. Hey, I've got a five-year-old. If you take my SpongeBob, I'm coming after you. In addition to the international wranglings going on, go ahead. One thing before we leave this.
Yeah, Phil Price on The Wave makes a point about the government using the internet to provide so many of its services through the .gov domains. And I think his point is that if we make it possible to just cancel someone's internet access, they're going to have fewer opportunities to access those government services. And that's a worthwhile point, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And educational services. Everything is moving to the web slowly and clumsily in a lot of cases. But, as far as getting reports, information, paying your taxes, what are you going to do if you don't have the web? It's not a good thing. So this is not the only way that the three strikes piracy plan is getting implemented or sought to be implemented. Also, we have a story in the link list there about a 34-page report from the MPAA to the FCC commenting on the role of content in the broadband ecosystem and asking the FCC to bless the concept of a graduated response program, in other words, a three strikes kind of program, in its national broadband plan. So this is happening on many, many fronts. And the MPAA, it's funny, Evan, that you mentioned before that your radar for the sky is falling kind of arguments had gone off in connection with the ACTA stuff. Because that's, I think Bill Patrie has a whole chapter in his book that I haven't gotten to yet, but just from skimming the contents, about a Chicken Little kind of approach to to posturing in from the other standpoint, from the content industry side. And God, I just can't recommend that book enough. He really illustrates how the rhetoric has a strong role. And I think, you know, if we look at the MPAA and what it's presenting here to the FCC, we see that play out in real time.
And just to interject, there's a great video that came out this past week at one of the students at I think it's Cardozo. Is that where he used to teach? Bill Patrie spoke there. I think it was just this past week, and about a lot of the issues that are in the book. So if you just, you know, look for the most recent video on YouTube that has Bill Patrie in it, that's worth the hour and 15 minutes it is to watch it. So that's what's really gotten me excited about the book.
I tweeted that, I think, yesterday. If anyone wants to find the link, it's there. At D.
That's
Howell
probably where
on Twitter.
I saw it then,
I haven't, it's an hour long, so I haven't made it through that yet, but it looks very worthwhile. So, you know, the MPAA is working on this digital guillotine solution on a number of fronts. And the other thing I wondered if any of you guys had time to watch was there was a 60 Minutes segment on the movie industry and how it's being strangled from its perspective by, here they're bringing in a whole bunch of mob and organized crime kind of overtones, but it's, you know, piracy at bottom, and how it's playing out on the business front is further amplified. But, you know, again, this copyright rhetoric just seems to escalate rather than have any sort of ratcheting down or solution. And I just wonder, you know, Ernie, do you see any sort of light at the end of this tunnel, or you know, is one side going to finally win this war?
I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel anytime soon. I think that, you know, this is all an outcropping of you know, the fact that this is a new technology, that there are new ways of distributing things all the time. BitTorrent, which was mentioned in that 60 Minutes piece. And I think when it was mentioned, you know, that's the way a lot of people learn these sorts of things. And 60 Minutes was careful to point out that BitTorrent, you know, has legal uses. But I'm sure that most people, after watching the segment, will conclude that BitTorrent is this horrible thing that only exists to enable piracy. You know, we just have a lot of misinformation, and we're in the early stages, so it's easy to miscast things, and that's what, in effect, is going on. And I think, you know, sadly, this is another example, you know, and this is our general culture now, is that we demonize and demagogue everything. I mean, every issue, you know, gets overblown in every segment of our lives. You know, in the legal world, where, you know, we are trained to think more precisely, we still get caught up, although, you know, it's not us that is the driving force, but we get caught up in the whole, for example, the whole debate about when we pick judges, you know, what's their litmus test on abortion, you know, and even when you're picking for the district court or the appellate court, nobody stops and says, wait a minute, you know, none of these courts deal with this problem very much. Let's not focus on this. The argument is, hey, let's manipulate the information and scare people and demagogue things, because that's the way we push the ball to one side of the field or the other to get what we want. We've thrown rationality out the window. We've assumed that people can be scared and cajoled and misinformed. So it's okay to misinform people and to, you know, to just try to win by whatever means you can. And I think that that's really what's going on. So I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel, because we're entering the fray now, And that's when everything is most susceptible to being distorted, which is what is going on. And the distortion is on both sides, really. I mean, I while I don't agree with what Evan was saying earlier, I agree that there definitely is a huge problem with people pirating copyrighted material. And I think Cory Doctorow is amazingly smart, you know, and for somebody who isn't a lawyer, you know, he follows things closely and has a lot of reasonable points to make. But, you know, he's not a lawyer and he has a point of view. And then other people have different points of view. I see there's a problem. I just don't think there's a very good conversation going on among intelligent people to try to really resolve the problem. I think the assumption is that if we can convince the large body of unreasonable people who are only marginally paying attention that we have a better viewpoint, then that's what we should do. So there's very little rationality, and I'm dismayed by that. You know, whoever wins, if anybody wins, I don't think it's going to be because they had a fair discussion about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were a couple of things that struck me about the 60 Minutes piece. Number one, there's a really cool graphic that explains, if you've ever wanted to sort of get a visualization, how BitTorrent works. There's this nice little graphic that they set up, but you're right, it tends to be something that is sort of scary for the uninitiated to watch when they see it and go, oh goodness, you know, how could you ever defeat something like that? But that's the reality of it, isn't it? That the distributed nature of how it works is very difficult to combat. And then, you know, movie executive after movie executive interviewed, and not one of them talking about changing their business model or addressing this in sort of a, you know, okay, this is the brave new world. How are we going to accommodate the users, the consumers' desires and what they're out there doing because of all the locks and barriers that we've put in place? You know, there's none of that. It's just, you know, the war escalating, and how are we going to further implement control? And I think that's what, you know, we see playing out in the other stories we talked about today. So as far as light at the end of the tunnel goes, I certainly didn't get any comfort along those lines from watching that piece. And it was a very polarizing piece. And you're right. Unfortunately, that's the way that a lot of people get their information, is from watching something like that. And then, you know, when it becomes a legislative item and people are lobbying the FCC and other policy-making bodies, then, you know, the information they've gotten may not tell the whole story. Go ahead.
Oh, it just reminds me of one of the other links you have in the link list today, is the story from the New York Times about the DVR being once television's mortal foe, and now it's helping ratings. So it's just another, I think one of the issues here about the, you know, what's the next business model and what will make media entities who have a lot that they're trying to protect, rightfully, you know, what do they do to access and make positive uses of the new technologies to enhance their businesses? And I, you know, the DVR is a good example where it was considered, you know, the end all, you know, the end for television as we know it. And I think there were many suits involving, you know, the time shifting suits were done with the VCR, but I think the same issue came up with the DVRs and TiVo's, you know, right to provide this service. And now it's, according to this article, shown that actually they're making ratings are better. They're able to sell advertising reflective of these ratings and things like that. So, you know, it's an example of maybe the sky isn't falling every time something new comes along.
Right. That's a fascinating article. Again, came out just this week, November 1st. So, and if anyone wants to see all the articles that we've been perusing as we get ready for the show, they're at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/37 for this show. And this one is just really telling, you know, that a couple of things have been the fallout of people using DVRs for a considerable amount of time now. Number one is that shows that might not otherwise find an audience because of their time slot, because they're more of a niche kind of a production, will find one on the DVR when people, you know, for example, a Friday night show. I think it was Dollhouse, which I'm a huge fan of, had a Friday night time slot, which is, I guess, sort of death for a show like that because people go out, etc. But it was it received a huge jump in its overall ratings from the DVR numbers. So that's a great way to get an audience for a program that is good but has been maybe time slotted wrong, or maybe is just not, hasn't got the broad appeal of another show. So that's one lesson. And then another one that was really entertaining is, you know, they track your various viewing habits with your DVR. That becomes very easy to do and something that you agree to in your service agreement. And they can see that people actually don't skip commercials as much as was feared would happen. That, you know, whether they're lazy or who knows, maybe commercials are getting better. I know that I have found myself, as I'm sitting there zipping through commercials with my DVR, I'll stop on, like, if there's a new Mac versus PC commercial, because those are ones I find particularly entertaining. I don't stop much. But, and in fact, I think it's pretty funny that our DVR usage in our household is so prevalent that, again, my five-year-old, who's growing up in this environment, he uses that analogy in other parts of his life. If something's happening that he wants to put the brakes on, he's like, "Mom, can we pause this? Can we fast forward this?" You know, I mean, it becomes a part of how they actually think about the world. And so I do think
which might kind of explain why, you know, in my household, we end up watching the commercials, because that's, you know, because we just forget the fact that we can, you know, fast forward. It's like, oh, yeah, this is recorded, or this is in the queue. So, you know,
fear that there's a backlash to this. You know, I mean, for parents who love being able to skip through all the very consumer driven commercials aimed at kids. And my kid is starting to clue into the fact that, hey, I actually might want to be watching those commercials to be able to know what's out there and available for me to
speak knowledgeably for when it's time to, you know, put the holiday list together, right?
Exactly. So, you know, yet another thing we try, and if we take it away from them, there might be some terrible backlash further down the line where they decide this is where their childhood rebellion is going to manifest itself. I'm going to watch commercials now. So who knows? Great. But according to this study that's discussed in the Times article, for whatever reason, people are actually watching the commercials on their DVRs. And I'm sure that makes the producers of the material being recorded quite happy. But, you know, I just hope that as more and more numbers like this come out, as you say, Colette, you know, it's evidence that there needs to be a shift in the conventional thinking about how we're going to lock up and control content and what's worth suing over and what's worth changing or preserving.
I think the motivation a lot of times is to slow down the change, because it takes these large entities with huge amounts of content time to adjust. And I would imagine that it takes them longer than a nimble startup to adjust. So, you know, I wonder if some of the motivation in this is to slow down and then try and extract some licensing, try and come out with a way to deal with the new stuff in a way that fits the old model. And then there's a period where they recognize that maybe that's not going to work, and some broken licensing agreement comes out of it, and then we move forward, and then 5 years later, they're like, oh, we love this technology, you know? So I don't know. I wonder if some of the motivation is to just slow down the pace with which these things are changing, to give the business folks time to catch up and the accounting people a way to figure out how to turn this into something that they can earn money on and not lose money on, which is, I think, you know, what people resist when you're doing well and you have a good cash flow. You're going to resist change to that, whatever system you're in, and you know, whatever it is. And I think that that's, you know, it's not, a, you know, it's somewhat human, I think, on some level, but in business, you know, it's, and law, it's not, I think it's dangerous to throw legal cases and legal arguments around without thinking through, you know, those implications. And maybe it's better to take that money you would have spent in several, you know, hundred lawsuits and actually put that towards fixing what you're doing or changing how you're doing what you're doing to embrace the new models. So
I think you said it very well, that it's you know, it's human. It's almost human nature to, you know, be resistant to change, especially if you're sitting pretty and you're the incumbent, and you know, you're doing well, and you feel threatened by a new kind of paradigm. I think that's human nature, whether you're in business or whether, you know, you're just doing something in everyday life. If things are going well, you know, change and dynamism and, you know, disruptiveness is something that's you know, viewed in no way other than a threat. So you'll do everything you can to throw up obstacles to that change, to protect the model that you've got going on here, and to you know, make sure that you have plenty of time to adapt to whatever it is that's next, whether it be to change your model or to somehow otherwise become compliant with how the world changes.
So another reason that I just love the internet is that, you know, for the last couple of shows, we have been talking about net neutrality issues, and there have been moves on that front from the FCC recently. And I think people tend to look at that issue as just a big, complicated mess and don't really understand what it might mean in practical terms. And somebody out there, I'm not even sure who it is, but the graphic, I think they posted the graphic in a comment on Crunch Gear, and then it just sort of spread around. I have a link to Device, D-V-I-C-E, where they have the graphic reproduced on Net Neutrality Illustrated. So that's what it means. And they've done this brilliant graphic that looks, you know, just like an ad for ADSL service, where you go ahead and pay a baseline fee, you know, your $29.95 presumably a month, and then all the things that get tacked on afterwards at an additional price, your search utilities, the Pathfinder, buy the Pathfinder package for an additional $5. Or if you want to reach international sites, that's an additional $5. If you want to get your news access, that's an additional $5. Ooh, things like entertainment, YouTube, Hulu, Netflix, ESPN, that's an additional $10. The social is actually thrown in for free under this fictional scenario. Oh, but it's just $5 after 3 months. And then we've got music for another $10. The marketplace where you can buy things, eBay, Amazon, Overstock, another $5, and then gaming, another $5, etc. Oh, and then you can give yourself a little speed boost if you want to for an additional $5. So you can see how these things would start to add up if ISPs were permitted to go ahead and differentiate traffic this way. And it does. It's like one of those things you would see at the end of Wired magazine. Artifacts from the future, or whatever they call those.
Right. Two points on this. I guess, you know, I like to bring up porn anytime I can. So mm-hmm. You know, that's obviously missing.
And
here,
we do appreciate that.
And this also kind of reminds me of, you know, when we, you know, we bought our house, you know, from the builder who was, you know, developing in the neighborhood, and our, you know, they list the base price, and, you know, our the joke that we would tell one another is like, oh, you know, the base price is this, but if you want a roof, you know, that's going to be another, you know, $4,000. If you want walls, you know, so it's kind of kind of like this. You know, the web wouldn't be anything without, you know, all of this stuff. So very funny.
Yes, kudos to whoever put this together. It's just dead on, you know, sort of cuts through all the texture and nuance around this debate and shows a bottom line scenario that's certainly more than possible. So thank you, person who made this graphic. I'm not sure who you are. But let's, as long as we're on the subject of carriers, let's bring up the greatest headline of the week that I've seen, AT&T to Verizon. There's a lawsuit for that. Thank you, Mashable, for coming up with that. Which means, obviously enough, that AT&T has gone ahead and sued Verizon for those ads that, I don't know if you guys have seen these on TV, that say there's a map for that, that go ahead and assert that there's, you know, the Verizon wireless map has five times more 3G coverage than the AT&T map, which is, you know, spotty coverage at best. And AT&T didn't like that very much, so... Again, rather than just fixing the problem, and I think, you know, anybody who's an AT&T customer might chime in and agree wholeheartedly with the ad.
I am this far, like inches away from jailbreaking my iPhone and going to T-Mobile or anybody else just to try it. I've been so frustrated. And I have an old one, so I can still do that. I know the 3G ones... you can't do that anymore. But
right, and you're in San Francisco. You don't get good coverage there?
Oh, it's horrible. It's so horrible. Wow. I mean, a few weeks ago, I was using my phone a lot one day, and I think I put it in my Facebook account. I was so frustrated. I'm like, every call got dropped, or something weird happened, or I couldn't receive it, or whatever, throughout the day. Like, I was never on the phone for more than 2 or 3 minutes without something happening. And I'm just beside myself. Like, what am I paying $120 a month for, you know? So,
yeah. You would think of all places in the country to begin.
I'm sorry?
You would think of all places in the country where service should be good, you know, where people are going to, you know, care about it, and where they're, you know, sure as heck going to talk about it too as well.
Yeah. But I have to say, back in 2004 or 5 when I was doing the fellowship at Stanford, I wasn't with AT&T. I think I was with Verizon then. I kid you not, driving down the peninsula from San Francisco to Silicon Valley, there are several drop zones. And then on the Stanford campus, it was really tough. I think other people with other carriers also had bad cell phone reception. I'm thinking, like, here we are in the heart of Silicon Valley. Our cell phones
cut off from the world.
poorly connected. I mean, I don't know if it's because there's so many hills, or I have no idea why, but it always kind of made me chuckle. So... But now it's getting to be the point. I think, and I've really noticed the AT&T service for me personally has just plummeted in the last 6 months. I mean, it was never great, but it was fine. And now it's like, I really don't know what I'm paying for anymore. So a lot of delayed voice messages, texts that come like 20 or 30 or half an hour after they were sent. And that kind of screws you up when you're trying to meet up with someone. So...
You know, all this does.
I get voicemails the next day sometimes on my iPhone, and that's frightening.
Yeah.
All of this does. All of this does kind of go into the legal claims involved in this lawsuit. You know, with the there's a map for that, because I haven't read the complaint or know anything about it, but I imagine it's probably allegations of like. Probably not in trademark infringement, I don't imagine, but probably, misleading advertisement under 43A of the Lanham Act. So it's like,
false advertising.
Yeah, it's not literally false, but it's misleading. Mm-hmm. And, in cases like that where, the literal falsity isn't at issue, there needs to be, expert testimony that talks about how it was misleading. And so it could be a little bit problematic to the extent that, it really is true and that the coverage is bad and much spottier than Verizon's and all that stuff. So it's, and I have to admit, I was, it's much more than just merely suggests, AT&T's in Apple's, you know, ads for that, you know, with, you know, there's an app for that. When I first saw it on TV, I was like, yeah, that's definitely, you know, a close one. And if they could be so, you know, bold as to get like a trademark or a dilution kind of claim going on here, I doubt they will, probably, because I don't know if they could establish the fame of there's an app for that as a trademark. I'm probably going way askew here.
Well, either way, it's a fair use, I would say. I mean, it's
a parody.
It's a parody, exactly. So
yeah, I guess,
I don't know.
I guess
there's
so.
Got to be a trade libel claim in there.
Yeah, Denise, I just got the call, so I have to leave.
Okay. Colette has to go do a very Good Samaritan kind of thing, so we can say farewell to her in good spirits.
Thank
and
you.
Glad you could right. join on the show for a while with us.
Yeah, have a good weekend. Next week.
Thank you. You too. I'll see you guys next week.
Take care.
Bye.
Hey, thanks.
Bye.
And folks can find Colette at vogelaw.com, I think I mentioned, and she's also at vogelaw. VOGELELAW on Twitter. So follow her and keep up with her doings. I thought that was one of the funnier headlines I saw this week. And I also thought it was funny that they would actually bring a suit over this. I mean, I guess there's nothing to be surprised about that, but it just seems kind of ironic in light of the complaints about their service. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, this seems like a good time to go ahead. I was sad not to be able to point you guys toward the Audible version of Moral Panics and the Copyright Wars, but do check that out in some other form. But I do have a couple of audio selections, a twofer for us this week. From audible.com that I'd love to point you all toward. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/twill, you'll get a 14-day free trial that includes a credit for a free book from audible.com. And then after 14 days, it's only $14.95 a month for one free credit a month. Well, you're paying for it at that point, but it's so well worth it. And these two, I think, are going to be great listens. I'm going to point you toward one that I've read and can't wait to listen to. Didn't know it was on Audible until I just checked this morning. By John Irving, one of the country's great authors. And the older book I want to point you toward is called A Prayer for Owen Meany, which is one of my favorite books ever. It's on my desert island list of reading material. If I were ever stranded, I would want that one there. It's a little bit disturbing and spooky and weird. And the main character, Owen, has a very distinctive kind of voice that I think would be just wonderful in an audio version of the book. So go check that out, A Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irving. And what prompted me to go find this favorite book of mine is that John Irving actually has a new book out, just out, Last Night in Twisted River, which is, let's see, in 1954, in the cookhouse of a logging and sawmill settlement in northern New Hampshire, an anxious 12-year-old boy mistakes the local constable's girlfriend for a bear. Both the 12-year-old and his father become fugitives, forced to run from Coos County to Boston, to southern Vermont, to Toronto, pursued by the implacable constable. Their lone protector is a fierce libertarian logger, once a river driver who befriends them. So John Irving just has a masterful way with language and character. And I think if you're not already reading his stuff, or you've probably read something in the past, his new one is something I am excited to check out. And I hope you guys will too, at audiblepodcast.com/twill. Thank you so much, Audible. And thank you all for helping support our sponsor. So, moving on, Ernie, you had a great story that you added to our list, and I think you had the good headline for it, Aliens versus Monsters, but without the cute characters. You want to tell us about what's going on in the area of outsourcing versus U.S. law?
Well, you know, this was interesting to me because I think it was last week we were talking about outsourcing a little bit. And, you know, it's one of those, this is one of those things where I'm always intrigued because in the beginning, when I started using cloud computing more, you know, and then there was some people saying, oh, well, lawyers shouldn't do that. You know, the data is inherently insecure. And then I started reading about people who are outsourcing work to India or outsourcing their phone service or whatever. And then, law firms would never do this because it's inherently insecure. And then along the way, the large law firms started to take advantage of some of these services. And I guess the thing that struck me was, nothing's inherently secure or insecure. I mean, it's all about risk and management and trade-offs, as Bruce Schneier, you know, constantly reminds us. And so here you have one where something bad happened. So you get the thing that happened that was bad was that there were some medical records sent to India to be transcribed, but apparently they were then being sold and captured, and you know, it was put out there, and so now this, the privacy's been violated. So then the story is always, because you know, if you're going to write one of these stories and you're a journalist, you want to get as many people to be shocked and you know, stir things up as much as possible, and you also don't want to have to do any heavy lifting. So the easy angle on the story is always, oh, well, they outsourced it and something bad happened. So that means, again, you know, the protectionist mentality can kick in. You know, there's all kinds of ways that you can get people who don't really think a lot to have a knee-jerk reaction and say that this is a bad thing. And, you know, there are aliens involved. That's always bad. Oh, my God, people, you know, in foreign countries are, you know, doing bad things to us. But the reality is, you know, we're sending that stuff over there because that's where it, you know, there are people who speak English, who need work, who can do the work and do it pretty well. And obviously we had a problem, but I mean, the sidekick scenario didn't happen in India. And, you know, that was a breach of privacy. That the other fiasco where all the credit cards were lost recently, I forget the name of that one, but you know, where hundreds of thousands of credit cards were compromised, that didn't happen in India. I mean, it's the nature of the internet, you know, that's really the problem. And it's the nature of just balancing risk. So, you know, these stories are going to keep coming up, and I just think it's important when we see them to realize that there's no easy solution to this, and that this is just, you know, part of the world that we're going to live in. So that's my little.
Hello, Ernie's dog.
Well, Ernie, I totally hear what you're saying with that, and you know, I mean, sure, there are knee-jerk reaction, or wait, I didn't say my knee-jerk reaction because you said that that's unthinking people, right? So, I mean, a knee-jerk reaction to this is think, oh my God, it's horrible because it happened in India and all that stuff. But at the same time, I don't think we can totally, you know, do away with the fact that it's problematic because it happened over there in India, because they're further away from the reach of of remedies, for, you know, when things like this happen, at least with data breach things that happen here in the United States, or, you know, when data is either through negligence or, you know, nefariousness of somebody on the outside getting data, you know, and putting it out there and having this information compromised, you know, what's within the four walls of the United States. And I don't know what that was supposed to mean, but, you know, within our jurisdiction here to deal with it. I just know that a lot of clients that I represent who outsource stuff to India, are very, you know, very encouraged by the cost savings that goes on, you know, with that. But, you know, we're also very concerned from time to time about, you know, ownership issues, you know, who's going to, you know, own the creative materials that's created by an independent contractor over there and all that stuff. So, I hear what you're saying. We don't want to be too provincial or too protectionist when it comes to all this stuff, but at the same time, it's scary to have all this stuff going over there. And I think that it may be something that we should have anticipated or expect to have seen things like this coming on, you know, the sale of private information that the outsourcers are dealing with, because, you know, the cost savings in India are almost too good to be true, and we can't expect it to last forever. We've got people willing to work for low wages, but with that, there's a greater demand for their services, and naturally, the wage that they would be demanding is going to go up. And so to the extent that the wages they're being paid aren't meeting the expectations, there's this sense of entitlement for these folks over there that isn't being met that would incentivize or encourage the sale of this data. So for the third time, I don't want to sound too protectionist or too provincial, but there is a certain way of looking at this to the benefit of providers here in the United States leveraging technology to have some of these cost savings that formerly have been enjoyed as a result of outsourcing the work overseas to folks willing to take a lower wage to actually do the work. It's a complicated problem and one that's not gonna solve itself overnight. And it's scary too, dealing with medical records.
And it's not even Halloween.
Right. Right. I guess we talk a lot about a lot of the scary stuff.
Yeah, it's like we had our spooky content show last week. but something that's equally scary and sort of related is the fact that a district court in Oregon went ahead and applied a Fourth Amendment analysis to that's search and seizure and what sort of notice must be given to you before a search, a government search of your personal material can take place. And this Oregon court decided, this Oregon federal court decided that the notice provisions of the Fourth Amendment didn't necessarily apply to emails. Oren Kerr over at the Volok Conspiracy had a good post on this. Did you guys take a look at this? And do you see this as a frightening development for the move toward more and more information being in the cloud?
Of course, yes. It's frightening. And I can see that I don't really understand exactly what the court held. I know that Professor Volok, he wrote something about it one day and then the next day realized he had misread the case. So my goodness, if Eugene Volok is going to misread it.
Was it Eugene or was it Oren Kerr?
Oh, was it Oren? I just know it was on the Volok Conspiracy. I know that's where it was. So maybe it was Oren who in any event, an author on the Volok Conspiracy wrote something about this case one day and the next day realized they'd misread it. And it was something like, whether the Fourth Amendment applies, was the issue that was apprehended. So I'm not going to be so immodest as to say I don't understand, precisely what the court's ruling was here. I know it's very complicated and pretty nuanced, but I do fear this whole notion of the general rule that if you are going to put your information or disclose something to a third party, then you no longer have a reasonable expectation of privacy. That's a doctrine that we kind of get from the pre-internet world. I think it had to do with phone records or something like that. And then, it's a similar to a case called Green, a Fourth Amendment case where, when you put your trash out by the sidewalk for the garbage collector to come and get it, you'd no longer have a reasonable expectation of privacy. All those principles are kind of woven in there that if it's with someone else or outside of your control, you don't have that expectation of privacy. One thing that I've been pleased to see in this context is the state courts from, in particular, New Jersey. I know that they have held that the Court of Appeals in New Jersey in a case called State versus Reed, which came out in January of 2006, I believe, that New Jersey courts consistently hold that there is a state constitutional right to informational privacy, even if the data is somewhere else outside of your local system. So, it's discouraging to think that courts would hold as a bright line rule, per se, if your data is with a third party provider, you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy. But as with all of the issues that we talk about, there are countervailing arguments to be made like that, made in this context, especially when you're dealing with, you don't want to subvert reasonable law enforcement efforts, especially when they deal with national security.
Right. I guess the misunderstanding Oren had about this case was at first he had thought the judge said, well, the Fourth Amendment does not apply. Its protections do not apply to email. And then he reread it and decided, well, okay, the court is assuming that the Fourth Amendment protections actually do apply, But because of the third party context here, the fact that the emails were hosted elsewhere, this negates an argument for Fourth Amendment notice to the subscribers. So the Fourth Amendment would apply, and you'd have to jump through all of those hoops in order to get at the information from the third party. But as far as the subscriber goes, they don't have to be notified at all under this case. So that's the scary part about
That's the weird part, because who has the greatest incentive to make the Fourth mm-hmm. Amendment challenge?
Right.
Are you talking the user or the provider?
Well, it's obviously the user. The user doesn't have to be notified. So effectively, you're diminishing the likelihood that there will be Fourth Amendment challenges.
Yeah.
It seems to me.
And another point on this is I don't think that this necessarily implicates only cloud computing, but it would implicate email kind of in general, right? Because there's always going to be copies of email out there, you know, maybe even in parts on servers between you and your intended recipient. So this could have broader implications than just cloud computing as we think of it in its modern notion, but in a broader sense for all types of more, you know, web 1.0 types of communications as well.
Right. And when I tweeted this out to put it in our show notes for today, Nikki Black chimed in and said, this is yet another reason why you really need to review your agreement with your software as a service kind of provider. That's easier if you're actually in some sort of position where you have an agreement that's been negotiated and that you can comment on and get feedback with. If you're using an email service like Yahoo Mail or Gmail, you're not really in that situation, unless you're using them commercially, I assume. So it's something to pay attention to. If courts are going to have confusion and esteemed analysts at the Volokh conspiracy are equally going to have confusion about how the Fourth Amendment might or might not apply to email. If you don't want your email subpoenaed or otherwise made public without your permission, it definitely pays to take a look at what your service provider's agreement says it can do. And I think what it typically says it can do in the consumer context is comply with anything it is required to do under the law. You know, if a government agency or if a person has lawfully obtained a subpoena in a civil proceeding and they bring it to someone like Google, Google doesn't have much choice but to respond to that. So yet another bogeyman out there in the cloud. Although maybe this is a comment on the policies that places like Google need to think about and establish on behalf of their customers. If this is what the judicial system is going to conclude, you know, I know Google has gone to bat for its customers before, and maybe this would be the kind of situation where, you know, it would draw a line and say, look, we don't necessarily agree that notice is not required. Or even if a court is going to hold it's not required, we're going to give it anyway and allow these people the opportunity to get involved in this decision and file an objection or however else you're going to be able to combat this.
I bet I know what they'll do. They'll allow a particular account to get a subpoena served on it three times, and after the third time, it's called a graduated response.
Yes. Yes, yes. Have you guys checked out this service that, you know, we've talked about Twitter squatting or the fact that there's this tension between there's no ICANN for social media type services where someone can use your brand or trademark on Twitter or Facebook or Blogger or any number of kinds of services where you can customize the URL where you can be located. Now there are services springing up to allow you to claim your social identity across hundreds of social media sites. This one is called Noam. This is on Mashable.
Another one called NameCheck, N-A-M-E-C-H-K, which for a fee will go out and register your username across hundreds of social media sites. Do you guys think this is a good idea, overkill? What do you think about it as a practical kind of approach to the problem that you otherwise might find your identity usurped? Ernie?
Well, I'm looking here and I see that the individual edition is $99, which is way outside what I would be willing to spend for that kind of service. So that's my first reaction. Great idea, I guess, if it works, but I don't know. It seems like it would be a really hard thing to implement.
Ernie, it sounds like you're riding on the city of New Orleans.
Yeah, it's the Orange Blossom special. It usually comes by about 2:20, so I'll mute if it gets really bad.
That's
or
great.
If my dog goes berserk.
I think it adds great context. You're right, Ernie. This is expensive, and
$350 for the corporate edition.
Oh, of course. I mean, don't we all know that there are really only about a half dozen places where it's important to be who you want to be? You know, there's Facebook, Twitter, wherever else. I can't imagine paying $49 a month to be automatically registered for 30 new social networks a month. I guess that's one way to make sure that you're the next big thing, you're not going to miss out, you know, like the next Facebook or the next Twitter, that you're actually going to, you know, be there and ready to go when it, gains in popularity. Probably the thing to be said about this more than anything else is that it's just a great tool for the more unscrupulous and nefarious to try to get to squat on names, you know, to make it, to put it out there. And
right, you go in, pay a fee and register everything for IBM, say.
Right, or anybody else that you know, want to get at. So, it's cool.
I don't know if IBM would think it was cool, but it could certainly be used for nefarious purposes. I'm sure that would violate its terms of service, but, I don't know. It's something that it seems like it would almost make me, it was back when I used to use Google Reader much more regularly than I did now, that I always had this guilt at the end of the day if I hadn't made it through my list of feeds, and then I kind of let that go. I think I've let go needing to make sure that I have my identity on every conceivable social networking site, and that, yes, there are a few where that really matters to me, but maybe not so much for the rest. I don't know. From a corporate standpoint, this just seems like something else to spend money on with not too much return, especially since I don't see a whole lot of social networking activity from the corporate side, definitely getting more expanded day by day, but enough to warrant this kind of an expenditure annually. I don't know.
I found it interesting
as a response just to the issue, which is not one I think that's going away fast, that it's so easy to have someone who has an axe to grind or just maybe the same initials or name as you to set up shop in a way that could be confusing.
In the next few years, the way that companies use social media is going to change. I'm not even trying to be a social media apologist or advocate or anything like that, but it's just the nature of the way that it is. And so who knows what the relevancy will be for leveraging a broad array of different platforms, on which to be social, through media. So I'm always thinking of how the semantic web and how, automated assemblies of data are going to change things. So, we may in 3-5 years from now reflect back on this conversation we're having here and think that we're missing some real obvious reason why you would want to automate some kind of procedure like this. But right now, I'm still, content with having a good presence on, those places that mean the most to me and that that I really actually want to spend time at.
Yeah, I think a sniper approach as opposed to a shotgun one makes more sense as you try and find things that actually work for you as an individual or as a company. And things tend to be to shift around, you know. I just let him bark, Ernie.
Hi.
That's okay. Of course, everyone remembers or maybe has blocked the old Friendster days. But even now, you know, I mean, I use FriendFeed and love FriendFeed, but I don't know that it's caught on with as many people or that it's good for particular purposes. I religiously set up a FriendFeed chat for each of our shows, but lately our Wave has been getting much more action. Our IRC channel has been getting much more action. I think you have to pick and choose where you're going to spend your social networking capital, and that these kinds of services, while interesting that they can exist because of this problem that exists out there, I don't know that I would invest in it. And now that's everyone's invitation to go squat on my name on all the obscure social networking type right. outlets.
Yeah. Did they close GeoCities down, or did I just dream that?
Oh, I don't know.
Because I was thinking, you know, make sure
seems
that you have...
It seems like I stumble across GeoCities sites every now and then, so...
Archaeologists are investigating it, I think.
Those are the good old days. I'm feeling nostalgic. Did you ever use Angel Fire way back? I mean, I think the very first my very first web page, my home page, you know, probably 1994, 1995 was on Angel Fire, and it's just amazing.
Yeah, wow. Those are like French cave drawings now.
Yes, yes. Every bit is creative. You know, with the blink tag in HTML, you know, you can't forget about that. That's great.
I used something that had home in the name, and I don't remember what it was, but it had this cute little graphic, and it was home something. But it was very WYSIWYG.
I hope you had at the bottom a little animated GIF with the mailbox lid opening and closed. You know, send me an email.
I think it was the next iteration past that.
Oh, geez. I was feeling all modern.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so another thing I found interesting this week was that Amazon has gone ahead and made it easy to tweet your Amazon associate link. So if you're recommending a book or you want to share it over to Twitter or what have you, they're using Bitly, if I recall. If you're an Amazon associate, you get a little dashboard at the top of your browser whenever you're in Amazon. So if you're browsing around and you find a book or an item that you want to recommend, there's now a share on Twitter button that links up to your account and automatically puts something over there. But that goes to something that we've talked about on the show before, the new FTC guidelines that are going into effect on disclosure and how it's difficult to do disclosures in 140 characters or less. Well, boom, Amazon has just made that more of an issue, I think, because not that I would tell them not to make things easy to tweet. Of course, that's a nice feature, and I think people will enjoy it, but it just raises this weird FTC issue again, where people are going to have to worry about whether they're getting some kind of compensation, as you do as an Amazon associate, for recommending something. Do you guys think that this is a problem, a symptom? Ernie, are you with us or muted?
No, you may hear Buddy periodically. I think I don't think it's practically speaking a problem, because I don't think practically speaking that the FTC is really going to, you know, clamp down on Twitter hawkers of Amazon information. But I don't think that many people are going to tweet that out. You know, I think at some point that will seem very spammy. I don't know that that plays well into Twitter. So practically speaking, I don't see it as a problem right now. I mean, legally, if you want to be a law professor and create a really interesting hypothetical to drive your law students nuts, this is a wonderful way to do it.
I think that if it's a problem, it's a problem for Amazon rather than the individual users there. I was making fun of Ernie for background noises. Now my phone's ringing, sorry. Because the FTC guidelines talk about, you know, going after the advertisers more vigorously, you know, of course, on a case-by-case basis. So, you know, Amazon having set this up, it seems like the onus now should be on Amazon to educate its, you know, the users that they, you know, should be aware of these guidelines. But I'm still in the camp with Ernie that, you know, this is probably something that's more interesting to talk about as a hypothetical in a law school class than it is here as a serious concern.
So have you guys upgraded to Windows 7 to the extent either of you uses Windows? Ernie, I don't even know if you've touched a Windows box in.
Well, no, actually, I upgraded to the beta version because I do use VMware, so I run Windows inside of my Mac, where I can watch it, you know, coming and going as it pleases. I like Windows 7 beta. I have not tried Windows 7 yet, but I'm definitely going to. I'm sure it's not that much different than the beta. But I've noticed that a lot of my friends are running out buying new computers because they were waiting for this to happen. So I'm sure this is a good thing for Microsoft and for Dell.
Right. So one of the things that was sort of ping-ponging back and forth this week had to do with the Windows 7 install process and a quote-unquote hack that shows that a Windows 7 upgrade disk could perform a clean install of Windows 7 on a blank drive. As opposed to just upgrading from something like Vista or XP. So there was some going back and forth about whether this was permitted under the license, not permitted under the license. And I think finally Microsoft came out and said, hey, if you are licensed to have the full edition of Windows 7, then you can do it on... You can do it in any way that you'd like, and it doesn't matter that you're doing a clean install, and it's just fine. You just have to make sure that you're properly authorized to have that. And I flagged this just because I think it's interesting that people find themselves in this conundrum that it's just so difficult for them to know because of the controls that are built into, you know, in this case, the Microsoft operating system, that they think that they have to actually engage in some kind of circumvention to do their legal install just in the way that they want to do it. And then it requires someone from Microsoft to actually speak up and say, oh, no, you know, never mind all the locks and protections that we have in place here. If you're authorized, you can go ahead and do what you'd like. I just think it's sort of ludicrous that people are put in that situation. Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons I love Apple. One of the many reasons I love Apple is that they don't have any copy protection, or you don't have to enter a serial number when you're installing the operating system. And it's interesting to me because I watch people switch over to Apple, and then they'll ask me questions, and they'll say, oh, you know, I can't find the registration number for my operating system. You know, what do I do? I'm like, there is no registration system. You know, you just put it in, and it works. And, you know, it's another thing with a trade-off. I mean, Microsoft is bigger. They're more concerned about piracy. They don't sell hardware, which, you know, Apple can be obviously looser because they make most of their money off of the hardware. But to the user, it seems like a huge annoyance to have to look for the disk, find the serial number. And it's usually they're looking for this disk when something catastrophic has occurred. So it's not like they're just lounging around on a Sunday, you know, and they say, oh, I'll just install my operating system and I can't find the disk. It's usually under, you know, in extremis conditions. And this just adds to the mayhem. So it's unfortunate for the user, but I do understand why Microsoft has to go down that path just because of their business model.
And I just agree with everything you said because you used Latin.
In extremis,
yeah, I had to work something. You know, I had to prove to people that I'm a lawyer because this is a podcast and I can't display my law practice certificate in the background. So, you know, if I use Latin phrases, that's the tip off.
Right. And I wouldn't even have, piped up and mentioned it if you had just said QED after you were done talking. So,
wait, I see Evans diploma right behind him there. So it's possible.
Right, right. I've got my diploma and there's a license too. So yeah.
That's right. If you're tuned in for the video version, you can see our various workspaces. And I actually spun my monitor around because I was so sick of seeing the blinds behind me whenever I glanced up at the screen. So now you guys get to see what I look at when I'm sitting at my desk. I look out at the doorway behind me and some art and stuff. But anyway, thank you, Microsoft, for making everybody's Sundays interesting when they've got nothing better on their hands to do than try and accomplish their new install or upgrade of Windows 7. And although we have a whole bunch more left in our link list, I think I'm going to save a good deal of that till next week. If there's anything else you guys want to discuss before we wrap, Evan, anything else on your mind that we haven't covered yet?
No, I mean, I've just spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, what we were talking about earlier, the copyright on an international scale. And, you know, that's really going to be interesting to go back and listen to what we were actually saying in the early part of, you know, this conversation, because there was an interesting dynamic going on there. A lot of times we're much more like-minded, and I don't know if I was, you know, over-polarizing myself on a couple of issues. So I've really enjoyed this conversation, you know, as an opportunity to kind of flesh out some of those ideas that are, you know, not insignificant issues as we, you know, continue to think about how the laws of intellectual property operate on the internet, not just in our own country, but, you know, truly in the global economy. So I think today's been very meaningful.
Yeah, I would love to take Bill Patry's book and send it to every law and policymaker that I could get my hands on and that I had any hope might read it, because I think it presents a take on leveling out the discourse that a step back from just the advocacy on both sides and sort of a historic perspective and, you know, how do we think about where this stuff should go?
Yeah, he certainly does a good job on that. You know, I mean, he definitely is a scholar of this area of the law, going, you know, way back even before the 1909 Act. And I think the value that he adds on that is this recognition of what, you know, we like to call this perennial tension between technology and the law, and that the issues going on here are absolutely nothing new, but you've got big incentives at both ends of the spectrum here, pushing toward, hopefully toward the middle on some kind of sensible resolution on how we're going to handle this extraordinarily complicated and nebulous problem.
Yep. Ernie, any parting words for us?
No, I just wanted to say that I've been enjoying using Google Wave, and I think that we're kind of, you know, fleshing out its use. And I was happy that Emoticon-y was able to join us today, the emoticon bot, which allows people to put little smiley faces and frowny faces. I think we're taking this podcast to a new level with Google Wave.
Oh, yes. Maybe wow. Maybe we'll have to put the Swedish chef in next time. We need Leo to do that voice. I certainly can't. Oh, and yes, Phil Price in the Wave chimed in with what my old website making tool was. It was Homestead.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, that was a fun one. Anywho, well, thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. We will be back next week at 11 Pacific Standard Time on Friday the 13th. So look for us then and subscribe to us in iTunes. In the meantime, we really appreciate you joining us for This Week in Law. Take care, everyone.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.